Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The guilty verdict against Derek Chauvin in the George Floyd murder trial has been welcomed by United Nations Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet, who said that any other result would have been a travesty of justice. This is a momentous verdict, Michelle Bachelet said in a statement on Wednesday. Her comments coming a day after Mr. Chauvin, a white former Minneapolis police officer, was convicted of murdering the African-American man in May 2020. He was filmed kneeling on Mr. Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes, sparking mass protests against racism. Ms. Bachelet praised the courage and perseverance of George Floyd's family and many others in calling for justice, but she said that fight for justice goes on for countless other victims of African descent and their families, adding that existing reforms of policing departments across the United States had been insufficient. COVID infections rose for the eighth consecutive week globally, with over 5.2 million new cases reported in the last seven-day period. According to the World Health Organization, which published the data late on Tuesday, the number of deaths also increased for the fifth consecutive week, with over 83,000 fatalities reported. All regions except Europe and the Western Pacific reported a spike in the number of weekly deaths. The largest increase was in Southeast Asia, owing to an increase in deaths in India, followed by the Eastern Mediterranean, largely because of higher fatalities in Iran. Data also showed that the pace of deaths is accelerating. The WHO said it took 9 months to reach 1 million deaths, four more to pass the 2 million mark, and only another three to reach 3 million deaths, that threshold being crossed last week. From one health crisis to another, and malaria continues to claim the lives of more than 400,000 people a year, mainly young children in Africa. In a call for action from member states to eradicate the disease altogether, UN Chief Antonio Guterres insisted on Wednesday that it can be defeated with robust political commitment and sufficient funding. A growing number of countries are achieving malaria elimination, said Mr. Guterres, and they've done it by providing prevention and treatment to everyone, regardless of their ability to pay for care. Coinciding with the Secretary-General's comments, the World Health Organization announced the launch of a bid to halt malaria transmission in 25 more countries by 2025. Of the 87 countries where malaria is still endemic, 46 reported fewer than 10,000 cases of the disease in 2019, compared to 26 countries in 2000, the UN Health Agency said. By the end of 2020, 24 countries had reported interrupting malaria transmission for 3 years or more. Of these, 11 were certified malaria-free by the WHO. At a time when global progress in malaria control has stalled, the protection provided by the RTS,S malaria vaccine, when added to currently recommended malaria control interventions, has the potential to save tens of thousands of lives per year, the WHO said in a statement. Katie Dartford, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we devote our entire show to the memory of one of the most extraordinary public servants of all time, Ramsey Clark.
We speak with three prominent attorneys who knew and worked with Ramsey Clark.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Our friend and colleague attorney Ramsey Clark died in his home in Greenwich Village last Friday, April 9, 2021, from complications from a fall. He was 93 years old. Ramsey Clark came from a prominent New Deal Texas family. His father, Tom Clark, had been the Attorney General of the United States and then served on the Supreme Court. The Clark family and the Lyndon Johnson family were friends and political allies during the New Deal. Johnson appointed Ramsey Clark to be the United States Attorney General. He served in that position for 18 months, severely disappointing Johnson, who remarked that he thought he was appointing Tom Clark's son. "I was wrong," said Johnson. Clark opposed the death penalty and declared a moratorium on it when he was in the office. He opposed wiretapping. He supported the civil rights movement and helped draft the historic Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 1968 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. He was a key person in powering federal desegregation orders. At a cabinet meeting, he declared his opposition to the war in Vietnam. That was the last cabinet meeting, he told us, that Johnson ever invited him to attend. He also disappointed and baffled many liberals and some people on the left when he took up representation of such figures as Sheikh Abdul Rahman, Milosevic, and Saddam Hussein. Clark said they deserved competent counsel. Here to speak with us today are attorneys Marva Hayden-Hilliard, Alan Levine, and Ralph Nader. Marva Hayden-Hilliard practices law in Washington, D.C., and is the director of the Partnership for Civil Justice. Alan Levine was a law partner of Ramsey Clark's for 5 years in the firm Clark, Wolf, and Levine. He worked as an attorney with the New York Civil Liberties Union and the Puerto Rican Legal Defense Fund. Ralph Nader is a well-known social critic of American society. He twice ran for president on the Green Ticket. His advocacy on behalf of consumers goes back to the 1960s when he successfully took on General Motors. But before we speak to them, we had some thoughts about Ramsey Clark.
Michael, what are your thoughts about losing Ramsey?
Well, Ramsey was a friend and a client. He told me that the single most formative experience of his life was what he learned when he went to the University of Chicago in 1950, and there he got a liberal education. Robert Hutchins was the famous president of the university then. Hutchins said that his idea of an education is to unsettle the minds of the young and inflame their intellect. The University of Chicago under Hutchins was a great place to be for Ramsey and his wife, Georgia. The liberal education they got was designed by Hutchins, as Hutchins wrote, to free a mind from the prison house of his class, race, time, place, background, family, and even his nation. And Ramsey's mind was indeed freed. He came to understand the great crimes against humanity inflicted by the United States, from slavery to the genocide against Native Americans, to the killing of a million Filipinos during the Spanish-American War, to the great crime of aggressive war committed against Iraq in 2003 under the Bush-Cheney administration. Ramsey, as a young man, wrote in an article called Neighborhood Bully that our overriding purpose from the beginning through the present day has been world domination, that is, to build and maintain the capacity to coerce everybody else on the planet, nonviolently if possible and violently if necessary. Ramsey wrote that the purpose of our foreign policy of domination is not just to make the rest of the world jump through hoops. The purpose is to facilitate our exploitation of resources, and insofar as any people or state gets in the way of our domination, they must be eliminated, or at the very least, showing the error of their ways. Ramsey led his life on those principles, and his activity in the United States domestically and his advocacy of peace and justice internationally will live on as his legacy.
Mara Verhaden-Hilliard, welcome to our special on Ramsey Clark.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Mara, I know that you and Ramsey worked on several cases together, especially over the last several years. Tell us briefly about some of those cases.
Well, I first began working with Ramsey Clark about 20 years ago, actually. And over the years, our work involved both litigation and struggles for justice, political struggles in the United States and internationally. And I think one of the cases that I really hold dear was working with Ramsey on behalf of Geronimo's descendants, the great Apache warrior. His great grandson, Harlan Geronimo, and other descendants fought to have Geronimo's remains removed from where they are held at Fort Sill in Oklahoma, where he was held as a prisoner of war and buried as a prisoner of war, and have them released to the family to be buried in the Gila Mountains, which is where Geronimo wanted to be buried. And we filed that case actually on the 100th anniversary of Geronimo's death in custody of the U.S. military in 2009 was the 100th anniversary.
Mara, what kind of stories did Ramsey Clark tell you over the years that you were together?
Well, I traveled with Ramsey in a number of instances. We traveled to Iraq in the lead up to the shock and awe invasion when we were investigating U.S. war crimes, when the U.S. government was actually bombing Iraq and Iraq cities every single day, which many people don't know. They were doing that well in advance of the shock and awe invasion. And of course, those kind of trips and the other places we traveled together through Asia, you know, you're on a plane for 14 hours or long rides in the back of cars. And I learned so much from Ramsey because he told the stories of the struggles for justice where, of course, it was never about himself. It was about all of the people that he met and the people that he cherished who had fought and who had suffered so much. And he talked about Dr. King. He talked about about leaders of the Black Liberation Movement and the Civil Rights Movement, of Bobby Kennedy, and of all those with whom he was colleagues, friends, with whom he worked.
Mara, you've written, and I'm going to quote here, from every court brief, in effort at impeachment, appeal to the United Nations, Ramsey genuinely believed that a just rule of law could prevail, that the structures of international law and the Constitution were mechanisms for justice and peace that were truly achievable. What qualities as a human being made Ramsey believe so strongly in that?
Ramsey had this extraordinary internal compass, a guiding star. That was how it always seemed to me, which was so crucial given the extraordinary demonization of Ramsey Clark by the U.S. government and by the popular media and by liberals and others who just sort of jumped on the bandwagon of attacking him and saying that, you know, the causes that he represented somehow, you know, the unpopular causes, the bad, quote-unquote, bad people he defended, without understanding that at every step of the way, what Ramsey Clark tried to do was fight for justice, and that he felt an obligation that as a citizen of the United States and that he had a duty to hold the U.S. government accountable and to try and help it achieve the highest ideals that he believed in. I mean, the truth is Ramsey was actually an extraordinary patriot, and he believed over and over again that it was possible to have the U.S. government, to have the world operating in comity under the UN, to create structures of justice where there could be peace, there could be justice, but that to do that, you had to take on these structures and you had to fight for what you believe in and what he believed in. And he did that. He did that uncompromisingly, and he was perhaps the most extraordinarily principled person that I have ever met, because he was unyielding and unafraid in his pursuit of justice.
He told us, we asked him, what keeps you going? And he said, hope. He said, you have to have hope. He said, without hope, you don't do anything. And I think that was the same kind of quality of optimism and hope that he shared with Michael Ratner.
I think that's, you know, a very important sense and assessment and awareness of what he thought. I mean, he was never cynical. He always believed that there was a great possibility for change. And he had certainly seen, you know, change in his lifetime. I mean, he had been an architect of the Voting Rights Act, of the Civil Rights Act, of efforts to end Jim Crow apartheid. And he kept pushing forward the change that he believed had to happen, and whether that was by being in court, bringing affirmative litigation, serving as defense counsel, or, for example, when he and I worked together on the initiation of the impeachment campaign against George W. Bush for crimes against humanity in the war in Iraq. And of course, now we can all see, you know, this many years later, how that turned out. And you know, we were meeting with John Conyers. He had drafted very concrete and very thoughtful articles of impeachment. He was a very serious person. None of this was for show. All of the work that he did was substantive, was meaningful, was grounded, and again, always grounded in the struggle for justice.
About the Cuban Five case, Ramsey said, quote, "If I were the Attorney General today and I found out about this propaganda campaign during the trial of the Five, I would have to dismiss the charges. Any Attorney General should do the same." Can you briefly comment on his relationship with Cuban issues?
Well, Ramsey was a supporter of countries' rights to be able to operate freely without blockades, without sanctions imposed by the U.S. government, because he believed absolutely that sanctions are illegal under international law and under the Geneva Accords. And of course, remember, Ramsey as a young man was at Nuremberg. I mean, he knew at his core and at his earliest the issues of crimes against humanity, and felt forever that these were obligations that we all had to uphold, and in terms of international law. And the fact is that sanctions are a collective punishment against a people in order to punish and cause regime change against a government leadership. And regardless of what anyone thinks at any time about a government, across the board, when the U.S. has imposed sanctions against a people, it causes vast death and destruction of children, of older people, a denial of access of medicines. It is a level of cruelty that is extraordinary. And he was, for this reason, he was against the sanctions against Iraq that was killing hundreds of thousands of children. He was against the blockade of Cuba. And when it came to the issue of the Cuban Five, which, as people know now, you know, these were five men who were trying to stop terrorist attacks on their country. And in fact, when they even reported the terrorist attacks to the FBI, they were the ones who ended up being arrested. They were the ones who ended up being imprisoned. And at trial in Florida, the trial was very corrupted, including by the fact that the Broadcasting Board of Governors was broadcasting in violation of the Smith Act very derogatory information and false information that was being broadcast into Miami that would have affected the jury pool. A lot of this is material that we uncovered in our organization through Freedom of Information Act requests, and that became central in the struggle over justice in that case. And again, time and again, his view was adamantly that the U.S. could never be a full place of justice, of peace, unless it was being held to account, unless its systems were forced to operate through a lens of true justice. And so he struggled against that, even if the press or even if the public or, you know, others couldn't understand it or didn't want to understand it. It wasn't ever going to force him to step away from the struggle that he thought had to happen.
I remember when I first met Ramsey, how I was struck by how modest he was and soft-spoken and casual and kind. He was really a man without pretensions. And I read that when he was in Washington and he was the Attorney General, he wouldn't take a limousine. He drove his old beat-up Oldsmobile. And that fit in with what I first learned about Ramsey when I was out in Detroit. I had to make a speech out there, and I was staying with Jim Lafferty, and I slept on Lafferty's couch, and Lafferty said, you know, the last person to sleep on this couch was Ramsey Clark. He went out to Detroit to do something, and he was put up on a couch, and he didn't complain. That was the kind of person he was. Did it strike you, his modesty and lack of pretension?
He was so understated, you know, understated, and he never walked around with a view of himself as above anybody else. He was so aware of the suffering of so many and wanted to do everything he could to try and stop that kind of suffering. When we traveled internationally, traveling to, you know, far reaches of areas of the globe, it was really interesting because he always traveled with this really small duffel bag, something that I never managed to emulate completely, even for long trips. And there were situations where if he was recognized, you know, they would try and put him in first class, and he would reject it. He would absolutely reject it because that just wasn't who he was, and that wasn't his goal.
Tall, rangy guy, and it probably wasn't comfortable, him sitting in the back of the plane, but that's where he sat. I remember when he was injured, you know, he was run over by a car and broke his leg, and he was told it was dangerous to fly because of the danger of blood clots, and he flew nevertheless.
And not only flew, but walked and walked and walked and walked through other countries, through streets, through hospitals. You know, everywhere that we went, he was so well recognized. People would come out, just people on the street when they saw him, and thank him. Just thank him, because he represented, in a way that I think many people in the United States don't understand and should appreciate, he really was this emissary that said to the world, the people of the United States are not your enemy. That the people of the United States, you know, want peace and want brotherhood and sisterhood. And that was a message that he really carried as one man, so that it was such a crucial message and such an important one, and people recognize that here's this American who's willing to stand up and say that he wants peace even in the face of demonization or attacks from his own government.
The stories that the Washington Post carried and the New York Times carried and the mass media, they were snarky. Really, all they had to say was that he represented Milosevic and Saddam Hussein and Abdul Rahman. They never really credited him with the kind of work that he did. They just took pot shots at him.
Why not explain why? I mean, that it says so much that this is the focus, that to just sort of put his name next to the names of these people and not explain what he thought he was doing, what he was fighting for, why he would be trying to seek justice. I mean, he was a decades-long advocate of actually having a fair and just international court that would have the ability to evaluate war crimes, and that would be from everyone and from all countries, including our own country. But he actually wanted to see courts and justice and the capacity to try people for war crimes. What he opposed was kangaroo courts. And what he opposed was courts that operated as a charade or deprived due process. And he felt in that way, and prosecutions that were easy victors justice. That's what he opposed.
Mara, we just have a couple of minutes. Just if we can leave with a few parting thoughts, what was Ramsey last working on, and what are your final thoughts about his life and legacy?
I think for those that actually knew Ramsey or understood him, understood what he stood for and what he was struggling for, he has been an inspiration. And I believe that he has impacted so many people in the United States to fight for justice, to stand for what they believe in against the odds, and to not be silenced, even when a cause or a belief for justice may be targeted for demonization, or people themselves targeted for demonization, really because of the impact of their work. That's a critical impact of his legacy, but also just the practical legacy of what he accomplished and who he was. He really stood for a side of the United States and a former representative of the U.S. government that showed what is possible, that he demonstrated and showed through everything he did and all of his work that it is possible to fight for justice, to fight for justice against the odds, but to try and make the world as you believe it should be in your deeds, in your actions, in all of your waking hours, and that's what he did.
I'm going to link to the biographical movie called Citizen Clark, and also to Gloria LaRiva's excellent remembrance of Ramsey in the
online magazine, Liberation, and also to the interview that Heidi and I did with Ramsey when he was representing H. Rapp Brown, Jamal Al-Amin, who was framed up and has been in prison now for about 20 years. And Ramsey did what he could to get him some decent health care to try to get him out. We'll link to that interview that we did also.
That's an important, another one of those critical cases. I mean, from the international scene that we talked about to the domestic cases, I mean, he fought for Harlan Geronimo, well, for Geronimo himself to be freed from being buried as a prisoner of war in a military installation. He fought for H. Rapp Brown. You know, he came out in opposition to the U.S. prison system in the 60s. And that's who he was in terms of understanding the structures in the United States that had to change if we were going to have a different society and one that could serve the interests of justice.
Mara, it's, as always, a pleasure to have your thoughts, especially about Ramsey Clark, who we all revered and loved. Thank you for all the work that you do, and have a great day.
Thank you both.
Alan Levine, welcome to our special on Ramsey Clark.
Thank you so much.
You began a law firm with Ramsey Clark and Mel Wolf. It was an unusual firm. Please tell us about it.
Well, I mean, Mel had been the legal director of the ACLU. I was a staff lawyer for the NYCLU. So we had come off these careers of great involvement with the 60s and 70s and political movements of that era. And Ramsey, of course, had been in the government for much of that time, and then as a private citizen, also deeply involved in those political movements. History should note that we were eventually joined by Kathleen Paradis, who had been the legal director of the Women's Rights Project at the ACLU. So, I mean, it was a wonderful combination of all of us having these deep involvements, and there we were all under one roof. And as Ramsey was quoted as saying, when the firm broke up 5 years later, there was a special spirit to the place. We were all excited about it. We weren't quite sure how well it would work. Our first act as a law firm was to draft a letter announcing the principles upon which the firm would operate, and my recollection is that the letter went through 13 drafts as we tried to, on the one hand, state our principles, and on the other hand, announce a viable economic undertaking, and that wasn't so easy to express in principles, and it turned out it wasn't so easy to manage during the operation of the firm. I think it succeeded more in terms of following our principles than it did economically. So for 5 years, we made a good living and had a good time and handled things that mattered to all of us.
What was it like working with Ramsey?
Well, Ramsey had this very public persona, but he was a rather private man, enormously gracious. He had this southern courtly charm to him. Early on, we were together in our offices one day and on a weekend, and he brought in his daughter, Rhonda. Rhonda, who was multiply disabled. Ramsey just treated her with such reverence and respect that it was obvious that Rhonda knew that she had an adoring father, and that was very moving. And I came in one day with my own 3-year-old, Abby, and Ramsey got down on his hands and knees to play with her. I mean, that's the kind of human being Ramsey was. Soon after we began the firm, there was some event honoring Mel, and Ramsey said a few words, and Mel's mother was in the room, and he took the opportunity to say something about the pride that Mel's mother must have in her son, which was really very thoughtful. He and I had a hearing down in Miami challenging a prosecution of some people who were accused of importing marijuana for religious purposes. It was called the Ethiopian Zion Coptic Church. Anyhow, so we had a hearing challenging the scheduling of this as a Schedule I drug, which meant possession was a felony. We had this long hearing. Anyhow, my mother, who lived down there, came there one day, and Ramsey got up during a break and went over to her and talked some charming, dear stuff about her son to her, and she just walked out quelling. And I mean, that was typical of Ramsey. The obvious answer to your question is it was a privilege to be working with him and with Mel and eventually Kathleen, taking on cases that we thought were important and indeed were important, and certainly representing important principles. It was a rare opportunity for all of us that we succeeded for 5 years. It was a source of great pleasure for all of us, and that, as I said, that Ramsey said it was a special place for him as well, meant a great deal.
Did you ever meet Ramsey's father, Supreme Court Justice Tom Clark?
Well, my first connection with Tom Clark was justices are given their big high-back leather chairs when they leave the court, and when Tom left, he gave his to Ramsey. Ramsey, who was spectacularly unpretentious, had the chair but had no interest in sitting in it, and I thought it would be terrific to sit in Justice Clark's chair, so I had it in my office, and made me feel somewhat connected to Tom. And then there came an evening when Ramsey was then ACLU Advisory Committee Chair, was supposed to speak at some event, and he couldn't show up, so they recruited Tom to take his place. And so there was some pre-event cocktail hour, and I spotted Tom standing over by himself, and I'm his son's partner, so I went over and introduced himself and told him that I was sitting in his Supreme Court chair. He responded very graciously. So at some point I said, you know, you and Ramsey came from this mainstream Democratic organization in Texas advocating, you know, mainstream liberal views, and now your son is off advocating these very controversial points of view. He's despised by lots of people. I guess that must make you sort of uncomfortable. And he said, well, actually, not the least little bit. I consider Ramsey a block off the old chip.
Can you tell us about some of the other interesting cases that you had in your firm?
Well, I mean, there was the one that I mentioned in which we had, I think, the first hearing that any federal court had given allowing a challenge to the scheduling of marijuana as a class one drug, meaning that its possession and sale was a serious crime under U.S. law. We had a 3 or 4 day hearing. Ramsey and I represented the members of this Jamaica-based church, which said that ganja was their sacrament. So we put on witnesses testifying to the importance of ganja as a sacrament in their church. We put on a couple of scientists who talked, including a man named Lester Grinspoon, who was a very prominent opponent of the criminalization of marijuana. And Lester testified to the essential harmlessness of marijuana, and certainly in comparison to alcohol. We had a prominent anthropologist testify about the importance of ganja in Jamaica, and it was an impressive hearing, and Ramsey was an impressive advocate in court. We lost the hearing, but it was certainly a terrific experience. We had a case involving a man who committed suicide in the New York City prisons. It was clear that the guards and the correction officers and the warden all knew that he was a serious suicide risk. He was in fact in a suicide watch cell, and inexplicably they failed to check up on him at the times they were supposed to, and he committed suicide. And we won a judgment from a jury that seemed to be, as far as we could tell, the first time that prison misconduct leading to a suicide had resulted in a jury verdict. I also argued a case for the firm that had originated with the Civil Liberties Union involving the removal of books from a school library on Long Island. It made its way to the Supreme Court, and it was the first time the Supreme Court ever considered the constitutionality of removing books from a school library. Books in this case that it removed because they had generated controversy that had been instigated by a right-wing political group, and we won that case. But, I think the legacy of the firm is not so much in the important cases we tried as a firm. I mean, Ramsey, before the firm, had been involved in important political trials, and he was thereafter. I think the legacy of the firm was that a group of us came together for a period of time, on the one hand trying to make a living at it, on the other hand ensuring that at no time did we violate those principles that all of us had held dear, and I think all of us considered it a total success in that regard. Well, thank you so much for having me, Mike and Heidi. Honoring Ramsey is certainly an appropriate undertaking for your show, and for me personally, having an opportunity to say something about Ramsey that I admired greatly was really a pleasure. So thanks for affording me that opportunity.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Oh, Clara. Whoa.
Welcome to our special on Ramsey Clark.
Thank you very much.
When did you first meet Ramsey?
I really can't recall. We both were in Washington at the same time when he was Assistant Attorney General and Attorney General, and probably met him at some gathering or some congressional hearing.
What was it like working with Ramsey?
Well, I didn't start connecting with him until he became a public citizen after he'd left government office. That was when he had decided, after having to make certain political decisions under the Lyndon Johnson administration, such as prosecuting anti-Vietnam War protesters, he had decided that he was never again going to compromise principle. That never again is he going to put his finger to the wind and say, how will this affect criticism of him or his future prospects or clients or anything else? And so he became a rock of Gibraltar for articulating what he believed was right, whether it was advocacy for global peace, whether it was defending dissenters in the U.S. or around the world, whether it would allow him to go into every area of justice that he wanted to go into, no holds barred.
Can you share one or two of the high points of your association with Ramsey Clark?
He was always a defender of groups that were considered far left. And the definition in the U.S. of far left is you basically tell the truth, that we have an empire, that we blow apart countries that don't threaten us, that we incarcerate people without due process or even adequate defense counsel, that we have a very rich country with massive amounts of institutionalized poverty, and on and on. And he was everywhere. He lent his presence and his reputation as a former attorney general to all these groups who couldn't attract press or who couldn't attract a sizable audience to their gathering. So I went to a number of them in Washington, D.C., where they had tables full of anti-war, pro-peace, pro-Palestinian rights, pro-rule of law, pro-equity, anti-racist, you name it. He was there, and he would be the featured speaker. Last time I went, it was for his 85th birthday in Manhattan. And you could see all the groups that he tried to give more visibility to. And he paid a price for that. By giving more visibility to groups who were standing tall for peace, justice, truth, facts, equal opportunity, he began to lose his media visibility. So he would very rarely appear, if ever, on NPR, PBS, New York Times. He became a non-person. But that did not dissuade him from continuing to do the right thing. He was oblivious to the tides of media coverage and lack of media coverage. He just continued to go to meetings, person-to-person gatherings, defending the deprived and discriminated and the destitute.
Ramsey said that the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a war of aggression, and he called it the supreme international crime, in the words of the Nuremberg judgment. Did you share that assessment?
Yeah, of course. It was a war crime by George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and all the people who were part of their circle. There was no declaration of war. It was not a country that threatened us in any way. So in the words of Ramsey Clark, he said, an offensive war is the ultimate international war crime. And it was certainly the case, and it continued to be the case to this day. Its repercussions, there's very little legal authority for our soldiers to be there, if any. Congress has abdicated and become an ink blot. And the same for Libya. He's stood up against the attack on Libya, which was accomplished by Hillary Clinton over the objection of Secretary of Defense Robert Gates under the Obama administration. She persuaded Obama to overthrow Libya. There was no declaration of war by Congress, no authorization of funds, no appropriation of funds. It was part of the Pentagon black budget. And the devastation to this day, 10 years later, hundreds of thousands of deaths, sickness, energy chaos, spilling into neighboring African countries, Libya torn apart, and still no accountability, no rule of law. And Ramsey Clark spoke out against that. His most controversial position is rarely understood even by civil liberties lawyers, namely that the most brutal dictators, once they're caught and under prosecution or an indictment, had to be subjected to due process of law and competent counsel. It didn't matter that they were brutal, that they had slaughtered thousands of people. They had to be enveloped in the rule of law in order to strengthen the confidence in the rule of law. And very, very few people understood that position. They would say, let someone else defend Milosevic or Saddam Hussein. And he would say it was his duty to join with any defense counsel, because obviously they had the entire public opinion against them when they were in the dock, these dictators. And so he believed that the rule of law and due process tested the legal system and brought out the most evidentially and morally based results. And he traveled everywhere in pursuit of that principle.
You and Ramsey also shared concern for the plight of the Palestinian people. Did you work with him on that?
No, I didn't work really very closely with Ramsey. I tried to support him when he did controversial things, and I was called by the press. I supported the documentary on him, A Man, A Life of Principle, which I think people now should look at in the wake of his passing to see the full measure of this great man.
Ramsey said that the world is the most dangerous place it's ever been now because of what our country has done and is doing, and we have to take it back. What ideas did you and Ramsey share about how to do this?
Well, I had Ramsey explain that on my radio program podcast, the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, about 3 years ago. And basically, there is no empire that compares with the U.S. We have bases in over 110 countries, bases, military bases. We have announced by George W. Bush and Barack Obama that we can go anywhere in the world with our military, that we can kill anybody, that the president is prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner in secret often. That was an Obama doctrine, including American citizens overseas. There is no such restraint as imminent threat or any other due process. And so Ramsey said, well, who else can compare to that? We're, as we speak, involved in the U.S. government is involved in 9 wars all over Asia and Africa. And who knows how many are in secret. And we've blown apart countries. We've killed millions of civilians and left others sick, injured, destitute, deprived of the most basic health care and other public services. It is interesting how people who refuse to accept that factual rendition are also the first to attack Trump for being a liar and for dealing in false realities. Well, what's their excuse for not recognizing what is in plain sight, that we are backing vicious autocratic regimes, that we are violating international treaties that we've signed on to, that we violate the Constitution? Trump was a chronic day-after-day violator of the Constitution and federal statutes. He violated federal statutes by issuing illegal executive orders contrary to federal statutes. He laughed at international treaty observance, and it seems to be a recurring situation under Clinton, under Bush, under Obama. We'll see how far Biden goes in restoring the rule of international law. Certainly has the experience to realize that it boomerangs against our own national security interests, and all empires, including the U.S., devour themselves eventually. And the U.S. has been devouring its budgets for public services critical in the United States so that it can fund a massive bloated military budget that is greater than the military budgets of the next 8 countries, including China and Russia.
In an interview you did with Ramsey Clark, he said, quote, if you don't have hope, you don't do anything. Ramsey was an optimist, wasn't he?
Yes, well, somebody who believes in principle and who believes in civic action has to be an optimist, because how do you get through the day being a pessimist? Pessimism has no purpose. It's an indulgence. And he recognized that, of course. But he also recognized the reality that there are a lot of trends in the world that are getting worse. That meant that people always had to be upbeat because that made them more functional. A depressed person in the civic arena is not very effective. And Ramsey had a very fundamental sense of humor, which also is part of getting through the day and becoming an optimist. It's also very important to be an optimist if you want to inspire young people who tend to be very prone to withdrawing and becoming cynical once they grow up to see the realities in the world and the gap between promise and performance.
Ralph Nader, Ramsey was soft-spoken, casual, gentlemanly-like, and very kind, so much so that Richard Falk, in an appreciation of Ramsey, wrote that he was extremely apprehensive about meeting him for the first time. Was that your appreciation of him?
He was a very easygoing Texan, and he had a lot of stories to tell from his upbringing in Texas, and he never lost his drawl and sense of humor. So he was a very easy person to be in his presence. He was not egotistical, just the opposite. But he wasn't excessively humble. He just was an easygoing person to get along with.
We've come to an end of our allotted time. We wanted to ask you if you had any final thoughts before we have to say goodbye.
Just that I hope his legacy is maintained, as you're trying to do. I hope the documentary on him gets viewed in small and large gatherings and becomes part of instruction in courses in international law and international governance and civil liberties and civil rights. And I hope the 2 books, one written on him exclusively by a law professor, in 2018, and the other written on him and his father, the Supreme Court Justice Tom Clark, will get read more widely. We do not want history to forget Ramsey Clark, because the future will be less for that if his life is forgotten.
Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Thank you.